Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show, welcome back. Our result of the week this week is ASOS. Retail writer Madeline Taylor is in the studio to help us break down that. Awash with cash. Will Flush Miners opt for deals, developments or dividends? That's our long read this week, written by one Alex Hamer. Alex is also in the studio. And then we take a quick look at the UK defence and aviation industry. Companies and Markets Show, welcome back, everyone. Joining me in the studio, Alex Hamer. Hello, Alex.
Hey.
Making their podcast debut, Madeline Taylor.
Hello.
Hello. Tried to book you twice before now, but didn't make it happen.
I know. I'll try to be less elusive in the future.
So, okay, at least we got you now. And then, as normal, Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, John.
And Alex Newman.
Nothing normal about Mark. Alex Newman, hi. Yes, hi, John.
Great. It's Wednesday the 13th of April as we record. Not for you, listener. You'll be getting this out on the Thursday or the Friday. We're doing this a day earlier due to the Easter weekend. As normal, a quick roundup of some of the news lines from this week so far. Wednesday morning, we've had news that British house builders have come to a firm agreement with the UK government to eradicate flammable cladding on buildings over 11 metres high. Under the agreement, 35 developers have committed a minimum £2 billion spend to fix their own buildings, plus an estimated £3 billion over the next 10 years via a government levy. GlaxoSmithKline have agreed a deal to acquire Sierra Oncology at $55 a share, implying a total value of $1.9 billion. The US firm develops late-stage biopharmaceutical treatments for rare forms of cancer. Elsewhere, despite a £550 million loss, EasyJet have marked down their latest report as progress, especially given losses last year hit the £700 million mark. Demand also seems to be recovering. During the second quarter of 2022, capacity has reached 67% of 2019 levels, while the third quarter is expected to hit 90%. Alongside EasyJet, we've got updates from Treats, Audioboom, Page Group, Microlise, Nanoco, Go Ahead, Tesco and ASOS in this week's magazine and on the IC website. You can find them all there. And that brings us nicely onto our first topic and our result of the week. I just mentioned it there. And Maddie joins us to talk ASOS. Last month, ASOS announced they'd be pulling out of Russia. If that's an okay place to start, how large were its Russian operations, aka what's the damage there?
Yeah, so at the moment, it seems like it will be fairly limited, the damage. So Russian sales only accounted for 4% of their overall sales, which is, you know, in comparison, their UK sales are much larger. They're sort of 45% of the total revenues. So it's not huge, but it still will hit profits. Management have sort of kept the profit expectations for the year the same, but now it's expected that they'll definitely come in at the lower end of the expectations. So expecting a £14 million hit to the profits.
Elsewhere in the results, I mean, what are some of the other takeaways from them?
Well, one of the things that investors have really been looking at is how retailers are going to hold up in a much more challenging environment. So we've seen inflation going absolutely mad recently, not just in the UK, but also in the US, which yesterday said that inflation had passed 8%. And with that backdrop, they're obviously expecting that consumers are going to have less money to spend on things like clothes because they're going to be spending it all on things like food and heating, where the inflation has been the highest. And so that's obviously posed a bit of a risk to ASOS. So far, they have managed to keep sales growing. So in the UK, sales growth was at 8% in the past 6 months and 11% growth in the US as well. So it's looking fairly positive. In addition, their chief operating officer, Matt Dunn, also said that he was expecting to see this pent-up demand from COVID be unleashed over the second half of the year. So it's yet to be seen whether that will happen, but he's predicting higher sales of what they call occasion wear, which is things like dresses, but also beach wear for holidays and all those things that we've not been able to do for quite a while. So they seem to have it under control for now, but the question really is whether or not they're going to be able to offset the rising costs with those extra sales, because they've also seen their operating costs rise really rapidly.
I guess it's an interesting environment for retailers like ASOS, because they are sort of a budget brand, I guess, which could do well in these high inflation times compared to more luxury ones. Is that fair? Or
yeah, I mean, their tagline is that they target fashion loving 20 somethings, and you know, you can see that two ways, really. I mean, one is that, you know, younger people are typically have less disposable income anyway, because they're on lower incomes. And so they might potentially be the ones to absorb the biggest hit if inflation keeps running really high. So you could see that as an even higher risk, the fact that they are a budget retailer. It's because it's their consumers that are going to be hit the hardest. And so, you know, in the past, you have seen luxury brands have a little bit more of an advantage there in terms of holding up against inflation.
I read an interesting piece from an analyst the other day, who I think had probably teenage or children in their 20s. And he said that because often these people might still live at home and aren't bearing those extra costs for inflation, like energy costs, they're actually going to keep buying trainers and other, you know, kind of fast fashion stuff longer than, you know, people might a bit older, or people who are more exposed to, you know, realities of life would do. I mean, you know, once again, he struck me as a parent who was complaining rather than writing a real rigorous look at this. But, you know, do you think there's an element of that where this kind of spending could continue more than we think?
Possibly. But then again, you've got to also balance it out against the fact that we've just come out of the pandemic. So, I mean, a lot of the people that probably were living with their parents over the course of the pandemic have moved back to the cities. They've moved back to London, where, you know, house prices have continued to rise, rents have continued to rise. So it's really anyone's guess.
Well, could I just pitch in on the fashion discussion here as well? Because I saw a separate note which I mentioned to Alex the other day about the cost push inflation that's going to come through because of the disruption to the cotton industry because of the war in Ukraine, and also because of other supply side issues as well. So we could see that that end of the fashion market, fast fashion as it were, becoming that much more expensive, and therefore perhaps out of the reach of its target audience.
But does that mean a t-shirt goes from being £5 to £6? I mean, this stuff's just so cheap.
That. Well, it is cheap as well. I mean, you know, perhaps it could work either way, I guess, on that basis. But and to your point before, Alex, as well, is that research has suggested that people actually will keep on buying small luxuries, as it were, during periods of downturn, and it's the larger purchase items that tend to suffer disproportionately. I should have known better, actually, to pitch in on the fashion argument. if anyone who knows me personally, it's not a hot.
You're wearing a very nice jumper.
It's a cable knit. It's quite expensive, actually. But
as seen on screen.
Yes.
Not our screens.
On your screens. our listeners will have to make do with their imagination, I think.
I was going to add to that. I mean, similarly, a bit of a fashion outcast as well myself, but I mean, I suppose for investors, ASOS was, for a long period, it was seen as it's basically the AIM's most triumphant. I believe it's moved to the main market, or at least had a couple of months ago, but its growth was absolutely phenomenal. It up to about 2014, it had, you know, it had one of the largest share price appreciations of the AIM market has probably ever seen. But some of the structural elements of the business model, which it, you know, advantages that it had there, so it didn't have the high street presence, it had a kind of viral factor by being on all online. It's just that's not a distinguishing factor anymore. Every retailer, fashion retailer, has really had to adjust and invest in their either the direct consumer shipping channels, or basically bulking up their presence on social media and kind of replicating some of the early success that ASOS and others had. And so the risk really, I mean, they're not the company, they can't return to the roots they had as a company when they were really, really successful. I think, you know, they've been incredibly successful in, you know, picking the stock that people are going to want to buy in the, you know, for this season and next. But the risk is they are just kind of becoming increasingly more in an increasingly crowded marketplace, and they're almost, you know, they're still very big. So comparison with the supermarkets is probably not fair. But their margins, you know, are just going to be more and more challenged as they compete with, you know, this kind of ever-growing online marketplace for fashion. I don't think the same numbers of consumers will look to them as the first port of call as they once maybe did, five years ago.
There's another thematic angle as well that we've become aware of, and that's linked to the environmental impact of the fashion industry. I read some figures a little while ago suggesting that it is one of the main contributors to greenhouse gas emissions when you take it through right from the production stage, you know, from the primary stage right through to production. And whether this will sort of impact companies within the sector, whether ESG mandates will be brought to bear eventually, or whether young people might just turn around one day if this becomes widely known and accepted, they just might turn around and stop buying from these type of outlets, sort of disposable fashion, as it were. I've seen some advertising for companies that are basing their business model on the fact that it's far more, that their apparel is far more environmentally friendly. But as I say, it's a thematic angle, and it's the type of thing that you need to be really keep an eye on as the industry progresses.
I mean, as our retail writer, Maddie, what's your sense on that?
Well, I think you've obviously got to be really careful about the environmental risks. I mean, you look at what happened to Boohoo. I think it was last year. They got themselves embroiled in a massive scandal about one of their, I think it was referred to as a sweatshop by others, but they're one of their garment manufacturing facilities in the UK. It was found to be paying some of its workers not very well, shall we say.
Or a subcontractor, so when it gets sued right away.
Yeah, so and we obviously saw a massive hit to the share price then too. So it is something we've got to look at and always be thinking about.
I guess just finally, maybe from an investor's point of view, you put a hold rating on ASOS, Maddie, and you also cited Berenberg, who've did slash their target price, but it's still way above where the price is now. What is there a more positive investment case for ASOS?
Well, I think it's a balancing act, really, because as we've said, their share price went up hugely over the course of the pandemic. And I think over the past year, we've really seen that come back down to earth. It's fallen by about 2/3. And so now it's sort of value. It is looking like it's better value than it once was. And I think investors have to keep in mind that it can't compete on the same sort of metrics that it was last year because of things like online retail no longer being kind of your only option, which was obviously a massive boost for them. So I think we've got to be careful before ruling them out completely, but also admit that there's a really challenging sort of 6 to 12 months at least ahead.
Want to know if you're on the right track to achieve your portfolio goals? Does your mix of holdings have the potential to deliver powerful growth? Are there adjustments you could make to boost your returns? If you would like to see your portfolio analysed by experts, please email us at portfolio.clinic@ft.com for more information or follow the link in the podcast description. This is a free investment review service and all portfolio submissions are welcome, whether you're starting out or have amassed millions. We don't reveal details of the portfolio owners, so your anonymity is guaranteed. That's portfolio.clinic@ft.com or follow the link in the podcast description. Let's move on. This week, our lead feature for the magazine was written by one Alex Hamer. Awash with cash, will flush miners opt for deals, developments, or dividends is the title, sort of blaring out from you from the front of your magazine, accompanied by a picture of a truck carrying stacks of cash. Alex, you wrote that the miners would historically make moves into M&A, but this time around that might not be the case.
Yeah, that's not the case so far. And I guess the real, there are two main points to this. Firstly, the idea is that will they just continue on with massive dividends because they've hit record payouts so far this year, and I think last year as well. It just kind of keeps ramping up. And then the second part is that the big miners like Rio and BHP, Glencore, Anglo American, they talk so much about these future commodities that will be part of the energy transition. So like copper, nickel, there's a bit of lithium development going on as well. And in a way, they're pitching themselves to broader generalist investors who are interested in this stuff, who might then invest on the basis of, you know, metal from a new mine that's, you know, operationally low emissions, blah, blah, blah. Going into the next generation of Teslas. You know, it's linked to that supply chain. I think that's a massive pitch they're making right now. But they're also not making the decisions now that we'll see supply of those metals be consistent in 10 years' time. And that's largely because the institutional investors, you know, your pension funds, your, you know, kind of small percentage point holders of these companies are keen to get these massive dividends, as you would be as an investor. You know, yields are running fairly hot, even with quite good valuations. And so what we've also seen, so on the one hand, you've got really high dividends, you've got good balance sheets, and then you've got capital expenditure or CapEx that has not really moved up that much since the bear market, which ended about 2016. So from 2017 onwards, you've got kind of minor increases in CapEx, and that what that's meant is that free cash flow has exploded. And that's where we're talking about use of capital and what decisions they're making now and how that'll affect the future. It's a big topic, and it will kind of keep rumbling along. And I think the comparison really is oil and gas, where investor pressure and a shift of capital away from this, you know, dirty old industry has meant that oil and gas supply has not kept up with demand coming out of COVID. And so we've seen price shocks. And, you know, there's good reason that investors want a bit of restraint in terms of spending, but will it go too far, I guess, is the question. And I don't really answer it, which is the thing with all, you know, with all big kind of analysis pieces like this. But yeah, it's a tricky question. And I think the investors I spoke to are very happy right now. And that will probably mean that dividends continue as long as they can.
Is the fact that they're flush with cash, is that based solely on the sort of exploding prices of commodities, or does it go deeper and a bit further back than that?
Yeah, no, that's a good basic question. It's so, for example, copper, which is probably 10-20% of Rio and BHP's cash profits a year, has gone from under $6,000 a ton to over $10,000 a ton. So that's a huge difference, and their costs have crept up a little bit recently, but that's contributed a lot. Over the past 2 years, iron ore has gone from under $100 to over $200, and it's back a bit now, but that has really driven this as well. So yeah, it's price driven, but they were in a really good position to capitalize off on these higher prices, because during the downturn, they slashed costs and got rid of expensive projects and really focused on, you know, cutting debt and making themselves a lot leaner. So that has also contributed to this free cash flow bonanza that we're seeing right now.
Alex, I think another point worth mentioning as well is that in the last the last super cycle, if you like, a lot of the big resource companies made some pretty unwise acquisitions during that period as well. And I think there was pressure from shareholder groups in the wake of that to actually, as you say, you know, improve efficiencies within the companies, but also to avoid those type of marquee deals that were, you know, conducted at the top of the market.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of a key point here when you've got Rio is my favorite example, where they bought a coal project in Mozambique that was based on the ability to ship that coal down a river. And when the government said, actually, you can't do that, it was an immediate multi-billion dollar write down. And they took their time telling investors, which has gotten them into snafu with the SEC in the US and other regulatory authorities. But that's really what investors are also trying to avoid. You know, the market gets excited and then decides that demand is going to stay what it is forever, and then they're going to spend billions on new projects and then, you know, ruin the market again. So I think there's this idea right now that without doing that, then the cycles will kind of flatten, which seems unlikely, but it's kind of staying so far. But I mean, you know, putting a mining truck full of cash on the front cover of the magazine could also just be pure peak market behavior. This could be the apex, and all these questions of continued free cash flow will be, you know, rendered silly within a few months. I mean, there are some forecasts that show that BHP's free cash flow is topping out this year at just over $20 billion. And then it's going back down to 15 by 2024. And the, you know, Rio and Anglo American have similar forecasts. Glencore will stay a bit longer because of the potential for copper and coal prices, which kind of determine their earnings a bit longer. But
presumably it's also making a killing trading, unless it gets completely stung in some opaque market we're yet to find out about.
Yeah. Well, the idea at the moment is that trading has become a real trading ground playing ground just for the giant companies, because no one else can handle the margin calls. There is this real sense that miners cannot be trusted with all this capital, so the investors should have it.
How much do you see that as just quite a short-term approach? You know, doing massive shareholder distributions, it's almost too easy.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because as I was saying, they've made these bad bets before. And the question is whether, you know, the right time to do these big deals, you know, buying mines that could be in production within a few years instead of a decade, for example, is kind of what could be happening, is that these deals should have been done 2-3 years ago.
Which makes me think on that point, sorry to butt in now, the Anglo-American's Sirius Minerals deal is looking quite good now, I think. I mean, it's obviously no consolation to the many Sirius Minerals shareholders out there who kind of took an absolute bath, but I mean, potash market is sort of crumbling as we speak, and they have this enormous resource which everyone's urging them to speed up. That looks like, but you know, that could have been a perfectly timed example of the sort of deal you're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, they got it for, you know, cents on a dollar. So yeah, it was kind of perfect for Anglo. And I think one other aspect is that, if we talk about copper, for example, which is, you know, so key for the energy transition, most of the current massive mines that are multi-million tons a year were discovered, those deposits were discovered in the 1980s or earlier. And there's been a few other big discoveries since then. I think I mentioned on the pod the other week, big one in the DRC, but there aren't kind of 15 large-scale copper projects just in a supermarket for the miners to go and buy, and those that are pretty good are very, very expensive. So,
am I right in thinking as well is that general yields are going down within copper and a number of other industrial inputs?
Yeah, for sure. The overall grade of copper globally is declining, and there are some processing helps that are, so new processing styles and they're still getting better at that, at actually getting the copper out of the rock. So that does help, but if your grade drops, that's pretty serious. So globally, it's definitely an issue. And there's really interesting things in nickel. So Russia produces, I think, 20% of the world's high-grade nickel, which is what is traded on the LME and is used in batteries like those in Teslas. And then your alternative is to mine a different type of nickel from Indonesia and then put, hundreds of millions of dollars of electricity into turning it into a better grade or a better type for those applications. And that has massive environmental implications as well. So there are quite short-term questions about Russian suppliers as well, but then longer-term questions about where you're going to get, the future demand for this stuff, or where you're going to get future supply for this stuff with such high demand forecast.
And the committee's looking at any new project as well. The world is just getting more and more complicated, isn't it? It's like, who your supplier is going to be. We're not, if it's overdone, the idea that we're deglobalizing or in this multipolar world, but it just everything becomes so much more complicated when, the dollar system is a weapon. And so if you pick the wrong location, then that's going to be massive equity wipeout. Rio Tinto's experience in Mongolia just goes to show how complicated it is dealing with governments now. We've got rising inflation, so there's added political pressure on any state to get a really good deal. It's like, why not just give the dividends away rather than have to deal with the incredibly complex judgments involved in building a new mine?
Yeah, and the mining industry used to talk about tier one jurisdictions, which was basically Canada, Australia, the US, Chile on a good day. But now you've got, so BHP and Rio own together this project called Resolution Copper, which was kind of seen as a slam dunk. They've already dug a kilometre or more deep shaft into the ground. But now, because they treated an Apache sacred site without due respect, so that they basically done a land slot with the US government to take this sacred First Nations land, and now the project's in question because they, what happened in Australia with Juukan Gorge, there's a greater focus on this, on not being horrible to First Nations groups, and now this massive copper project in Arizona, which was seen as super easy, if not quite expensive, is now in question because of the way they've handled this Apache site. And so you're getting, kind of furthering your point, saying that even in places where previously you'd assume the project would go ahead on purely economic grounds, now that's also in question.
Well, thanks, Alex. That's your feature, Awash with Cash, available magazine, website. All good retailers, et cetera, et cetera. You know the spiel. Right, we're going to move on to our final topic. Now, the UK defence and aviation industry looks like it could be losing another of its members. On Monday, the European Commission approved US engineer Parker Hannifin's acquisition of the UK-based aerospace manufacturer Meggitt. I believe there are a couple of antitrust stumbling blocks, but I think if Parker sets its aircraft wheel and breaks the vision free to be its own separate entity, that's all well and good. I believe that was the commission's statement. Anyway, the upshot is UK government and business secretary Kwasi Kwarteng has a decision to make over whether this is an issue of national security before approving the deal. Mark, lots of news lines around this one, and you wrote about it very briefly in a market roundup. What do the UK government have to weigh up here, especially in light of the Ultra Electronics case as well?
There's a number of considerations all linked to national security concerns. I mean, this is a debate that's been going on well before the Russia's invasion of Ukraine as well. The UK, almost uniquely amongst European nations, didn't have provisions in place to stop foreign takeovers of industries that were deemed essential in terms of national security. But I think there's been a sea change in that regard. The government has actually given powers to regulators to stop deals on this basis. And I think a lot of people were actually surprised that the Mega and Ultra Electronics deals were allowed to go ahead in the first place as well. I mean, the central irony, of course, is that Cobham is involved as well, itself a venerable UK defence company. It's just a case of there's such a tie-up as well between the government in this country and the defence contractors through links with GCHQ and with the military itself. And so you've got a position now where we've seen the value of UK armaments in the Ukraine war, and it is just a simple question: is it worth sort of hiving off this intellectual property to third parties, which in some cases will sell that on to nations that are essentially hostile to Western interests. So it'll be interesting to see what the business secretary does in relation to that deal. I guess you could say that it's so far down the path now that it's likely to gain approval. The central irony, it'll only leave about four FTSE 350 companies in the defence stroke aerospace sector. So in a sense, the argument is moot, but we shall see. At any rate, we shall see. I pointed out a few weeks ago as well that we might see further consolidation in the UK market, but of course that's a different kettle of fish.
Is there precedent for the UK business secretary or the UK government sort of vetoing sales on the grounds of national defence?
Well, I dare say there's more than one example, but I just think in comparison, but it's been pointed out that in comparison to other European nations, for a long time we didn't have those provisions which stopped sort of key national assets being sold off under the national over national security concerns. I mean a lot of the UK's IP in this regard are centered on two larger companies within the sector as well. So when you look at our, I think the UK is right about the eighth largest arms exporter in the world, and it's been going down the list in that regard. I think we've got something like 2.8% against France's 11%. So some people might say, what is the relevance of it then? But the UK defence contractors, by definition, are tech focused. So it tends to be at the higher end of areas like aviation and electronic warfare, which and also and I say aviation, but autonomous drones. I mean, we're almost ahead of the curve in that regard. And it is if you're a company like the Czech Republic, that they produce a lot of arms, but it's the kind of thing that anyone can produce. Rifles, ammunition, things that are absolutely vital, but they don't have the same import in terms of intellectual property.
Well, thanks, Mark. something to keep an eye on. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on over the coming weeks.
John, what's it good for?
A good question. Good question. Great. Well. Thanks everyone for joining me. Hope you all have a cracking Easter, and we'll catch up with you again same time next week. The Companies and Markets Show was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And because you listen to our show, you can trial the IC's print and digital subscription at the special price of just £4 for 4 weeks. Follow the link in the show description to redeem. Have a great Easter weekend, and we'll see you next week.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.